You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast. Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is another live edition recorded at the Gilded Balloon in Edinburgh 2012. Now, clear your mind, take a deep breath, and let's spend an hour inside the head of Terry Alderton. Hi, Terry, thanks for coming on.
I've got to pull this bit up. I'll tweak it out. It'd be easy. Hello, everybody.
I should say as well, I've already, having said to you, having prepped you and said, hey, man, we don't need to be funny at all, I realise my compare instincts have gone, please welcome a very funny man, Terry.
Exactly.
As if you now have to
going,
come
on. Oh, my God, I've got to perform.
He's got to start going. So you absolutely don't have to start performing today. We're going to try and find out, not so much what makes you tick, although that might come into it, and we know you tick often, but also the root of it all. I mean, you, for those of you that don't know Terry, you hold, I believe, the record for the most consecutive encores at the Comedy Store.
I think that was some PR thing that was done, yeah. I have had a few.
What I mean to say is, for people who haven't seen you, you're not just a very good comedian, you're unfollowably good. Like, when famous people come down to the Comedy Store, they don't want to go on after you.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I suppose so. I'm not a bad interview, by the way. You think I'm just a little bit embarrassed?
Sorry, yeah, I do have a tendency to gush over people that I'm so excited have come on the show. So apologies.
Yeah, no, it's very kind. I think also because I create, it's not just the level of performance. I think that, you know, the strength of what I do. I think it's more the bizarreness as well these days. So
yes. So can you just kind of just to place you in context for anyone watching now or listening at home? At some point, who no one is listening at home right now, but I will be. You've all just clammed up, really, are they? We'll be podcasting this later in the year. So, just for people who haven't seen you, can you describe what it is that you do?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I find it quite hard to describe what I do, and it's probably a detriment to me, and also obviously an advantage because, of course, I can't be pigeonholed. Obviously, when people are trying to do stuff, they don't know what to do with me. So I'm in that kind of catch-22 area. But essentially, what I do is I create kind of a drama triangle on stage. So I have myself performing to you people now, and then I have two inner voices in my head that I talk to about what's going on in my mind and what I think what's going on at that point. So they create trouble for me, basically. And from that point, you know, I then try and rescue it out the front. So that's kind of...
Sure.
Why is he talking about this now?
I don't know. They're not going to interview us.
They're never going to understand what he's on about.
So I don't know if you quite understand what I'm on about.
So, and as well as the voices, there are sort of a kind of a running theme under all of the stuff that you do. But you also, it's not just kind of stand-up. It's not, there are observational stand-up elements of what you do, but also there's dances and kind of like ludicrous musical
bits,
interludes, and you try and lick your own elbow to music. Which is fantastic, incidentally.
What was the question? I think my observational thing isn't you know, I've got a drawer with things in it. You might have the same drawer. It's not really that kind of observational material. But I think what I try to do, there is some sort of method, and that that I kind of relay my mind. And sometimes I think people kind of in some bizarre way kind of realize the same thing. And it's not me going, oh, have you ever noticed? I just do stuff that I'm hoping the audience are going, I understand what's going on here, but I don't know why.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just a feeling of something going, I kind of get this. That's kind of what I think, but I can't generalize about everybody because I don't know that everybody ticks the same, but I generally know that most people want to eat and have to use the lavatory and go to work and have pretty much the same angst and, you know, sure, gripes and happiness and, you know, whatever, Christmas and, oh God, we've got bills to pay. So I kind of know that certain points of a human being, we kind of work the same to, sure, a degree, but I may take it a little bit further and maybe not as far. So, you know.
Sure. So to just describe what a Terry Alderton hour is like. I saw your hour the other week.
My name. It's horrible when you say my name.
Oh, sorry, mate.
No, I know, but it's weird because I'm in reality now. What you don't understand is when I go on stage,
sure,
it's like I perform like this, if you like. So I immerse myself in a world. So now I've got no mask on. So it's, yeah. this is me.
Justify yourself.
So this is where when people do go, I hate that bloke. You suddenly go, oh God, now I'm a bit bothered because that really is me.
Well, let me try to describe it then, and you can agree with or disagree with the thing.
Let's see if it's what I want to be portraying. It'd be interesting.
Oh Christ, now the pressure's on.
No, it's not. There's no pressure. We're not trying to save any lives.
That's a very good point.
That's just comedy, isn't it?
So, in the show last time, there was a section in the show that I saw last week, your new show, which you're kind of
coming, growing show. Yes, yes.
Okay. So you're, I mean, yeah, where do you even start? It's like a bomb's gone off in someone's mind.
Well, someone described that's it last thing. Night, which, if I can be as bold, someone said to me last night, watching you, but no, someone asked them what I was like. They'd not see me. He said, it's like being drunk watching a French film or a foreign film. That it was like, you know, just, oh, no, sorry. I apologise. He said it was like being drunk watching a foreign TV show, you know, sometimes. And I kind of imagine when you suddenly flick on at night and there's some mad Italian show when you're in a hotel in Italy and you're going, what is this weird game show? I think probably that's...
Yeah, and elements of it, you go, oh, this must be what's happening and now. I think that, and other times you're completely lost.
Exactly, and I think that's what it is. And you know, you've got to be, you know, sometimes I'm lost up there. So anyway, I
sure. Sorry. But also it has this quality of, I think of you as someone who plays the audience, like in the way that someone who is an observational comedian could arguably stand there and say their lines when there was no one there. You could read out the jokes, they could practice. Mm. But you are the embodiment of someone who is actually completely engaged in what you're doing because you feed off the audience and you create, like Ken Dodd creates, that kind of rolling laugh. It's, you know, and he's famous for doing these great three-hour shows where you find out what things are funny and then you just get on it. You're like, you're more like a kind of a surfer almost. You're instigating something happening.
Exactly,
and
that's what the drama triangle is, so to create. But what I do, I bring it out, you know. So when I talk to the audience or I use the audience, it's not really a case of just getting a cheap laugh. It's you know, I like to get the audience a little bit sort of like, you know, firstly, don't know what's going on, you know, what we're going to do next. This is something my mum always used to bang into me. My mum, she used to just say to me, you know, you've got to keep people just sitting there going, what's going to come next? So it was kind of inspired by my mother, that. But it's also, you know, the fact that grabbing someone around the head is also a delight to the rest of the audience because it's not them, but it also the whole angst of where's this going to go because there's this big baldy lunatic in his ear. You know, telling him he's got a rainbow inside his mind, you know, which was last year's show. But, you know, but even though I know that there are certain points that I know I'm going to call that back. So I have a strength to that point that I've put a rainbow inside somebody's mind that I know I've got an opportunity of a window to ad lib as much as I want.
Yes.
Because I know I've got the strength of the callback of the rainbow. So that's kind of how sure. I set it up.
Sure.
So there's this degree of knowing what I do, but within that, I don't know what I do. I didn't even know I knew that, actually. I have to be honest.
That's one of the first structural things I remember from the first time I maybe saw you, which will be something like 6 or 7 years ago, was the Superman t-shirt under your shirt.
Exactly. It was always a chance to pull it back. I did a Fathers for Justice thing, and if you know what I do, I don't really tell you. You'll know the nights that I do because I'll realise there's quite a popular majority of the audience, also, well, not a majority, but there's a number of people that really don't know what I do, so I have to just cheat it slightly.
But you mean on any individual night there'll be people
sometimes
who know what
I know
expect.
That. So, yeah, I've been saying, you know, but watching me, you know, if you've come to watch my show, it's like joining it in season 3. You might be a bit lost. You know what I mean? lost was not the pun intended, but. But the Superman t-shirt idea, what it was Farnsworth for Justice, which I never told anyone. It just kept bringing back my kids. So it was this, but what it was, that it would grow and grow. So, you know, the first one would be Give Me Back My Kids, you know.
Well, it would, I mean, it would initially start off like, then you'd have the Superman music.
Yeah.
You'd start on button your shirt to reveal the thing. You know, so. And then the music would cut off and you'd shout, Give Me Back My Kids.
My kids, yeah.
With, yeah, I just to
sorry,
keep
yeah, I'm not very good at explaining, which is probably why it's worked. Not, is it, eh? So I, then from then on, there is a running theme, and the theme, of course, is every time I pull it open, I'll say something like, you know, Boxing Day is not like Christmas Day, is it? You know, but the reason for that, they were safety net, so it was a lovely thing to have. I really wish I could get it back, because you know you'd be taking the audience, you know, you guys on a journey, and at any point I'd feel a dip, or I'd need to pull your focus back. I just could whip it open, and I tell you these things because it's no great shakes, but. The theory, it is based upon all comedy theory, and I decided to look at the science of things. Where I used to be a very mainstream comic, you know, I was a very crowd-pleasing comic, the days of, you know, of the Comedy Store and you know, standing ovations and all this, which I don't get as much now, but I find that I'm doing something more interesting, so I'd rather forget the standing ovations, right? But before, it was all happy, big, and, you know... all crowd pleasing, and I think when I was structuring gags and things, and I was just going, that will make people laugh, you know, that will make people laugh. And my theory of comedy is that we learn to play, if you like, it's not probably a very good simile, but a piano, and there is only so many chords and sequences that you learn, and then what you do once you've learned the instrument, let's say, like I said, piano, it's what you do with it. And with comedy, it's very much the same. I think it's like digital. It's like the comedy timing is like binary. And it has to be the one and zero. It has to be solid. It doesn't move. To get a good laugh will always be the same drop. Same as a ballad. When someone will sing a song, they'll get to the final note, they'll stop, and then they drop the note. And that's pretty much what I've just done there, comedy timing. Sure. And you can go around two or three times and wait for that. So what I decided to do was take a kind of a science. I was looking at the science of it, thinking, how can I take those things that I've learned, or the solids, the digital of comedy, and then try and reinvent it some way? I can't reinvent the wheel, of course, to quote a cliche, but I thought I could tackle it from another way.
Sure.
So all the talking and all this stuff and all the pulling out the T-shirt, that is still the same as any normal straight stand-up would be doing. They're still the same, whether it's Tim and Vine doing one-liners or it's Doug stand-up doing what he does, you know, mm-hmm. and he's... brilliant sort of observation of the world is no actual difference to what Steve Martin or I'm doing. You know, it's still the same rules. The rules are exactly the same. It's just how we're tackling it.
Okay. Well, that reminds me of something. I saw Harry Hill do an hour of new stuff here at the beginning of the festival. Mm. And if you've ever seen Harry Hill's stand-up as opposed to his TV work, the way he, you know, he got known for, as well as his incredible imagination, was he would get one-liners, break them in half, and then separate them over... you know, over time. So the structure would become part of the joke as well.
Yeah.
But as you say, it's the same notes well, he's it was playing, really, he's just you know, playing them with different intervals.
If you think about it, it's no dissimilar. You know, I'm not saying I feed it or I may be inspired by it and didn't realise, but you saying that, thinking back, it was no different to really me pulling my T-shirt open, because he from nowhere suddenly would go, turns the milk brown, doesn't it? Turns the milk brown. And that's, I think, was a similar idea.
So this is Terry. It's very difficult for us to be specific about what he does. That's what I'm aware of listening back to this. It's a little bit like the Dr. Brown interview. You're just going to have to take my word for it. It's not traditional stand-up in any sense, really. With Terry, it's like an explosion of ideas and fragments of character and dance and sound effects, all sorts of stuff. Go and see him. He's just an electrifying performer. Google up his website. You can see him on Live at the Apollo. He's got a clip on there. But go and see him live. Go and see him live. Find a live date. You'll never forget it. Now, having said that, that element of it is a bit like the Dr. Brown interview. This interview, I think, is like none other, really. Terry's hyperactive here, as I'm sure you can hear. He's incredibly candid. He's very ready to talk about some of the more problematic aspects of his career and of his life as a performer. I am enormously fond of Terry. I think some of the issues he's describing here are common to a lot of stand-ups, a lot of artists, and I'm very, very grateful for him, to him for being so open. Very open, as you'll hear. I barely get a word in. And I really hope he overcomes his feelings of being an outsider, because I find him utterly inspiring, and I think he really deserves the happiness that he's looking for. So now to the ads. Two very quick things. First, Nish Kumar at Soho.
You'll remember this is the guy who did the excellent Josh Widdicombe impression in the live episode a few shows ago. He's a brilliantly funny, very, very charming comedian. He's a super goldsmith. He's a big fan of the podcast. The podcast is a big fan of him. He's on at the Soho Theatre on the 24th to the 26th of January. So that's in a couple of weekends' time. He really, it's the show that should have been nominated, I think should have been nominated for Best Newcomer last year. But the fact that he wasn't will probably make him a better person. He's that sort of bloke. 24th to the 26th of January at the Soho Theatre. And if you buy your tickets for that in person, you can use the code BollywoodLovejoy and you'll have to pay double. And remember, you can be a super goldsmith as well. All you need to do is tweet about the show at ComComPod or join the Facebook group, recommend it to Facebook friends of yours who you think would enjoy it. They don't even need to be real friends. You don't even need to have met them. Write it on bits of paper, hand them to strangers, key it into people's cars, get tattoos of the logo on your face, whatever you like. If you want to be a super goldsmith, please tell the world that Pappy's episode was a blinder. So that's a really good entry episode, I think, to recommend to people. Anyone you think's a fan of Pappy's, a fan of comedy, or a fan of whatever the stuff is that we get into on this, life, art, things, whatever they are, just tell everybody about it. That's how you become a super goldsmith, which I'm resurrecting. I was initially a stupidly improvised thing, and then I was a bit embarrassed of it, but now it's kind of grown on me. Finally, of course, the James Acaster Comedians Comedian special is on Wednesday the 6th of February. There's still a few tickets left for that. It'd be lovely to sell it out. That's going to be a brilliant gig. I cannot wait to do that interview. James has really got his head screwed on comedy wise. I think that's going to be fascinating, and the gig will be great as well. He's on tour around the time of doing it. He would probably say he's doing it whilst being on tour, but from my perspective, he's on tour around our gig, and I think you should look up tickets for him as well. Go and see him on tour, but do come and see that show. I think that'd be brilliant. We've had some great Funny for No Monies from last week, but I'm going to give you a bit more time on them because I'm doing some lovely gigs in Dubai at the moment and I'm recording this in advance, so we'll come back to those next time. Thanks for listening. Now I shall return you to Mr. Terry Alderton.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So let's talk about the origin then, and where, because we'll talk more about where you've ended up, but let's talk about where you started. You say you were a very mainstream act to begin with. How did you start? How did you go from being human to extant?
Well, I just wanted to do something different. You know, I saw my dad working hard, as we all see our parents working hard, and you know, I kind of had played football and I thought I wanted to do that. And then I wasn't good enough. Basically, it was rubbish. I like to say I had a bad injury, but I didn't. I was just not very good.
You say you weren't very good. I mean, you were a professional football player.
I was good to a standard, but even in that, you know, now, you know, if I'd stayed in football, I'd be obviously, maybe I'd just still be playing because I'm same age as Brad Friedel, but he's a bit bigger than me. But I would have always been a very lower league rubbish goalkeeper, whereas I think possibly I'm a kind of not sort of I'm just sort of playing for Wigan and nobody really knows who I am in the Premiership. So as a comic, so I'd rather that than being I'd rather be in the Premier League playing somewhere in my profession than just being this basically I'd be painting and decorating. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but I shouldn't have said that. I didn't mean it like that. It's just what happens is there's a cliche in football, when you stop playing professional football at a lower standard, the joke is you're going to be painting soon, you know. So that I turned into Walter White there, didn't I? No, I'm cooking crystal meth now, come on. You can't get into that, no one knows who's where yet. Oh, the dodginess of it. Anyway, I didn't realize I could do a Walter White, but yeah, so I saw my dad work hard, as we all do, and I just thought, I don't want to answer to anybody, really. I know that some people might think that's a bit wrong to say what I'm saying, but I'll be candid with you. I didn't want that. I just wanted to be my own creation. I wanted to be what I wanted to be. I didn't want anyone to tell me what to do or have to be somewhere, because I was doing jobs and I was just thinking, I don't personally want this for me. I didn't want that. And I happened to do impressions, and I saw an ad in the paper while sitting in a basement smoking a cigarette and having a coffee with my friend who was only 18. And I said, oh, there's a thing here. If you think you're funny, come and do an open spot. So I went down to the Joker Club in Southend, and Lee Evans was comparing. Yes! the Rubber Bishops was on, and Patrick Malba was on, and, you know... This you know, great comics of the time were all playing. You know, of course, Bill Bailey was in the Rubber Bishops and what have you. And I did this 5 minutes, and the guy running the gig said, you know, you're not quite ready yet, but, you know, this is this new TV station starting called Sky, and they're doing this thing called Sky Star Search. This shows how old I am now, right? So he said, you know, they're doing these auditions for this thing with Keith Chegwin, and I said, all right, I'll go and do it. And
Cheggers, I'm in.
Yeah, exactly. I saw him not long ago, and we were talking about it, funny enough, because I went, I did the heat anyway. I did the audition, I did the heat, and then my dad came up to town with me, and we did it. It was lovely doing this with my dad. It was beautiful, right? So he'd come to every one with me. You know, we'd go up there. So I did the heat, the semi, beating Chesney Hawks in the semi-finals, and he wasn't the one and only. And then I won the final. Right, so I'm 18. I won, and I'm rubbish on this. I should put this on YouTube. Really, it's terrible. I'm just doing impressions of people that don't sound like them. But I won this thing, and that was kind of the start of me going, you know, actually, possibly there is something in this. And I worked on a holiday camp for like a year. So
when you were doing, when you became that first incarnation of you doing stand-up, like you doing more mainstream stuff, as you described earlier, were you writing jokes then for that? Or were you just walking on stage and making it up?
No, it was just nicking stuff. You know, I didn't know what it was about. I think in the first instance when I was doing the impressions for Sky Star Search, I had written that was a kind of, I sat with a piece of paper and did something funny with my impressions and what have you. So in the first instance, it was how it should have been. I think that when I started working on this holiday centre in Great Yarmouth called Potter's, it's a private place, right? They do the bowls there now, the World Bowls, right? That's when I met a load of old pros, and then they were trying to sort of tell me that I had to, you know, was giving me gags and jokes, just old jokes, you
old
know.
Old pros in the kind of holiday circuit, right?
Exactly. So then you'd be watching comics come in going, well, it's all right just to nick their gags, right? So at that point, I was just after the laugh, you know, and I was every single night going on that stage and dying, right? And now I just won Sky Star Search. I thought I was a lick, yeah? Like, I thought I was cool, yeah? You know that? And then I was just dying, just dying. But it was a great process, of course, when I look back on it. It was the best thing that could have happened. Just kept dying and dying and dying. And then I left that, and I got a pantomime with a friend of mine who I've unfortunately not friends with anymore, but... He was the start, really, of saying, you know, you've got something here, and then you have to go to the alternative comedy circuit, which I'd, of course, already started at. And then I went back, but of course, I went back with the whole... My ethos was, of course, you know, you nick gags, don't you? And you do these old crappy things, and of course, people were going, you know, who is this guy? What is he doing on our circuit? My God, he's mainstream. So from the get-go, I was completely alienated. I was, you know, everybody hated me from the start. It was like, who is this guy? You know, and I learned quick that, you know.
So who were your contemporaries then when you came back? Well,
Well, at that time, there was people like Paul Morone and what have you, who was a crap joke demon, you know. These guys don't even exist now. And there were people, the Brighton Bottle Orchestra and all that. They don't really, they're not even around anymore. But then there was the likes of... you know, the Owen O'Neills who did befriend me, you know, and the Steve Frosts. Of course, oh, bloody, I haven't seen him for ages. Little Spazbagger. What's his name?
Oh, God. Anyone?
On the he's basis in the Young Ones, but I can't, he plays Spazbagger's doll in the Young Ones, and I can't flipping remember. Lee Corns.
Okay, yeah.
Who was very alternative, which was quite strange. And of course, if anyone knows Steve Frost, you know, really out there kind of comics at the time, but then had befriended me, you know, and then were just sort of whispering in my ear, it doesn't quite work like that here, but we're very nice. And I know in O'Neill and whatever, you know, we're very nice. And then there were others who I'm now friends with, like this circuit comic called Sean Mio. You know, we're friends now, but I remember my first dealings with Sean Mio when they were all talking at this Jonglers dressing room. It was a bit like this, actually. And I just said something, and Sean just turned around and went, "You're not ready for this conversation yet." And I went, all right. So I just sat there. So,
oh my
but
God.
What is interesting is the so-called, I say so-called because it's not anymore. It's just comedy now, isn't it? But with the old mainstreamers, you know, they're more crazy and whacked out, even though their stuff is just like, what? But their actual offstage thing is very loving and very nice, but also crazy.
Okay.
Whereas I found with the alternative comics, they were very straight people, you know, who weren't very nice. And were very much against the isms, rightly so, you know, the racisms and sexisms and all that, you know what isms are, of course. But I found that actually that there were very, it was a very anti-working class thing going on there. And I still think, and I'm going to stick my neck out here, right? I still think there is a little bit of that. I still think there is a bit of that, you know, and...
an anti-working class
I think
sentiment.
There is slightly. I'll be honest with you. I've never said that. And, you know, and I'm not one for class things, but, you know, because we live and we grow and we become what we are. And I don't, working class, upper class doesn't really matter, right? In how much money you got. It's just what you want to be and who you want to be at that point. And that's where I am as a person. But I do sometimes feel that, you know, that may have held me back a little bit. And then people say, well, there's arguments there, of course, you know. If,
sure.
You know, I
mean, do you mean, Russell Brand might be, an anti-working class sentiment amongst other comics or amongst promoters or TV people?
I think with comics at one point, not now, but at one point, definitely. But it just still, I still think there's a kind of an elitist thing, and I still think there is a bit of that. I really do, you know. Okay. And I think that is another reason that I really thought, you know, because there was a point where I was at the depth of my, you know, I got depressed because that's what comics do, but I did. And in 2004, I wasn't doing comedy anymore. And then I saw a review on Chortle that Steve Bennett had written. And I mean, I was in tears. It was the most, I mean, you know, I was not in a good place. I was trying to be amongst something and do something and was storming gigs. Excuse me, weren't you? But then I read this review and I remember the windows being steamed in the house because my wife was steaming some vegetables in this cold night, and I knew I had to get my windows done. And I also knew I'd had this climb to, I'd been on like the lottery show and hosted this like with Lulu, and you know, I'd had this kind of 1999, 2000, I'd been at Perrier nominated. It all happened, you know, I was getting all this TV, all these scripts were coming in, and then nothing. And then I've got to a point, that slippery slope of trying to rescue that TV thing and bereaving in a way. Had this bereavement. It was ridiculous. And then I was in London's Burning, and I'm doing these lines, and I'm looking at people thinking, what am I doing here? This is ridiculous. I'm in London's Burning. And so in 2004, I read this review about myself because my wife said, you got to go back doing comedy, and I didn't want to. And I think I just popped and did a gig because I'd stopped for about 3 years. And it's this review of that Bennett had written saying that, you know, Chortle was proud to be a critic of mine.
Yes, you know. I remember reading that.
And it was so scathing and upsetting. But the flip side was, it was one of those, this is to where I am now, that I just looked at that and it kind of, you know, I picked myself up and thought, right, do you know what? I'm going to show you now that... Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you want alternative comedy. Here it's going to come and hit you in the eyes now. I'm going to give you alternative comedy. So I've since said to Bennett, you know, there's a point of me wanting to punch his face in, but there was also a point that, you know, I may have to thank him because, you know, he started the ball rolling for my whole reinvention. Love it or hate it, you know, I'm pleased where I am now. So I want to kiss him and punch him.
Okay.
You know, so.
You look physically capable of doing both of those.
Well, I look physically. So, you know, someone's trying to start a fight with me last night. A cab rang. It was a brilliant moment. Yes. Some 22-year-old. He was pretty buff, this kid. He was like that. He's going like this to me. And I'm just thinking, what are you doing? But it was really weird because he was kind of a, he seemed like he was quite educated and you know, and maybe a student here. And his girlfriend was very much like, Tom, come on, Tom. Right. But I got his name. And I know that's a key thing, isn't it? In a situation like that. And he's doing this to me. I went, Tom, what are you doing, Tom? And you could see him literally go, it just deflate. Just saying his name and then making it, you know, like a personal thing.
Yeah.
It's funny. But anyway, sorry, I've got onto, of course, later on, I smacked him with a wrench in my, in the imaginary fight as I went to sleep. I thought, being beat by a 22-year-old, I can't have it. Sorry, I don't know. I've completely hijacked the thing now. And I was some...
It's, you haven't hijacked it.
Gratuitous violence.
All I'm slightly confused as to exactly where in the process, when you were doing the lottery show,
yeah,
and you were doing clubs at the time and yeah, doing really well at clubs, what was your material like then? Was that your own stuff? That wasn't, you weren't nicking
stuff? No, it was my own stuff, but it was like, you know, it's like when you're on a plane, or do you know what it's, you know, it's all that kind of thing. Okay. Which, of course, at that point, nobody wanted anymore, yeah? So, you know, there was all that going on. Me going, I'm going to reinvent. Of course, now we're looking at, I'm off me head doing me comedy madness, right? And then they all want Michael McIntyre going, I was doing that shit ages ago.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and fair play to these people now, you know, but it's funny. But it also is a learning curve as well, that you have to believe in what you want to do, you know? So there is a bit of you that wants to play a bigger crowd, you know, of course you do. You want the playground to be bigger and more in people enjoy and embrace what you're doing. But it seems to be at this point in time in the world that I'm living in, I don't know about with you people as well, but, you know, people want, it seems to be quite lowest common denominator at the moment. I don't know if that's we can blame the X factors of the world or might be, sure, but people just want it. And I'm not dissing anyone here, mm-hmm, you know, but the bigger comics.
I certainly feel like you're describing a feeling of being out of step with what's with the zeitgeist.
Maybe. Yeah.
And I wonder,
or wanting to be, or opting out myself, in fact.
Yeah. I just wonder if there's an element of that maybe that is to do with you having an impulse, an initial impulse to give people what they want, not just audiences, but to kind of give the industry, this idea of the industry. If you're the kid in the dressing room and someone's saying, you're not doing the right stuff here, you're not welcome, that then you want to do what will make you welcome. Because that's something I really feel. And I wonder whether in my, you know, I used to be a street performer and everyone was clambering out in the audience and doing all the rest of it. And now I feel there's this thing where I've tried really hard over the last 5 years to let go of all the crazy out there elements and actually write really good crafted stuff. And now, of course, in the last 2 years, there's suddenly this vogue for clambering into the audience, picking up the audience, and everyone's going, oh my God, it's so amazing. And I feel like I'm in a similar sort of step.
Well, you know, going, Steve Martin was doing that in 78, wasn't he?
Well, exactly.
I hear what you're saying, and you know, for me, you know, the only disappointment is because I have an ego and I'm a comic, you know, I wish more people got what I did, you know, and there is a point to me that I just think, is it Emperor's Clothes, or, you know, some people really have bought it and get it, and it's also funny for me and the people in the audience who do get it. So it could be arrogant, this, don't get me wrong, but it's borderline, but it is very funny, and I do mention it in my shows, to watch people who don't know what I do, just sitting there going,
I saw that in your show last Friday when you said
it's so funny.
You were talking about there are people who know who I am and have bought tickets, and there are people who were convinced to buy tickets.
Yeah, it's a season 3 thing.
Yeah,
but it's not in any way, you know, leaving anybody out. It's just that, you know, sometimes, you know, some of the comments I get on Twitter, I've come off it for a while. Don't get me wrong, I'm not bothered about what people think. It's fine. It's just that I got completely engrossed in it. I had to get it off my phone.
Sure.
Because I just thought, I'm constantly on this crap all the time, Facebook and all that. So I've taken it off. But, you know, comments I've had, you know, it find that people, when they don't get comedy, or they get very angry. They can get really angry. You know, people have wished my mother to have cancer because I'm unfunny, apparently, you know. Tweeted me that, you know, you're so unfunny, your mum gets cancer. You go, mate, it's only comedy. I'm not trying to do anything.
Sure.
So there's a bit of me that kind of wants to battle with that as well, you know, and open that sore up. You know.
But then I think from the point of view of the shows, to be dividing a room, to me, seems like almost a badge of honour. I mean, you want to make everyone go for it.
This is the catch-22. If you're a clown, you want everyone to love you. You know, I don't want to come out in this room and have half of you not like me and others love me. I don't want that. I want everyone to love it. And it's all have an experience. As me as well, come off beyond that curtain going, yes, what, we did it, kind of thing, you know. Don't think for a minute I want to split the room. But it is also very funny to me, though, if there are people sitting there just going, you know, that point of them going, what is going on here? Of course, there's nothing going on. Is when people go, I don't get it, you know, because there's nothing to get. That's the whole joke. It's the nonsense. Look, you know, if you looked at the likes of Kaufman, you know, people would say about Andy Kaufman, you know, they'd go, you know, he's not funny. Now, I can see he's not funny, but that's his shtick.
Sure.
His whole thing, and I don't know if that's right. You know, I don't know if that was right. But I, as a comic, admire that someone would do that. You know, the fact that to stand on a stage in front of people and knowingly know that you're going to make them think this isn't funny, and then getting angry and crying about it, and then just coming back on for no reason and start playing bongos.
Yeah.
You know, is to me, it's still the same tricks, you know.
Sure.
There was a point in my life, you know, I was just growing to this point that I'm at now and believing, you know, and I said to my wife, I've got to go to Australia and New Zealand. I did 2 months away from my son, you know, because I knew I had to do this reinvention, you know, and I was thinking about all these guys in my head, not trying to emulate them, but just knowing about them. And paid a lot of toll on my marriage, actually, which we've now hopefully got back together. But until I've got a real bit of finance and then she's out. But, it really did. You know, it was a gamble all round. But at the end of that run in 2010, I thought, right, you know, I'm really getting this now, because it was my show in Australia. I had an audience that wasn't right, you know, and, you know, I was trying to lead them. And then I found myself just in the end giving in and doing material like, oh, so you've got two buttons on your toilets, one's for a wee, one's for a poo. And I'm on stage doing this thinking, what are you doing, man? This is falling backwards now. This is rubbish, sure. Guff, you know, but knowing they wouldn't laugh at it unless I went to that place, you know. Yeah. And a few comic friends had come in and said, you know, you've got to lead the audience like you would, what you started to do. And I thought, so doing late night shows were great. So I was going out and doing late night shows and just absolutely losing my shit out there, you know. And then realizing, thinking, I'm getting this now. This is all happening. But there was always a bit in me that would hold back, worry about the critic, worry about what someone was saying on Facebook about me, worrying about that tweet, you know, still not having that power. And then in the end of 2010, I was driving to Wisbeach and I downloaded Steve Martin's autobiography, Born Standing Up. And that was the single key figure in my career where I went, this is where it's all going to change.
Okay.
That and was a single point. That is I one point I can actually pinpoint where it just went, game on.
Yeah.
And I listened to that all the way to Wisbeach and back. And I urge you, if you like comedy and you want to do comedy, I don't read very well, but he reads the book. You can get it on, you know, places to download, starting with an I.
Yeah.
If you are going to get into comedy, I urge you to listen to, or I would say listen to it, but if you like to read, that's fine. But it is, to me, for me personally, there were four secrets in it. I'm not going to tell you them. There are definitely three secrets of comedy. The reason I won't tell you is because you need to find them to realize. You need to have the realization, the epiphany, okay, to go, oh, because that's what happened. I sure just went, oh my, this is it. And now, you know, I'm all powerful. So I don't care now. You know, I see, I lied to a little bit. There was one other thing that was that joined that. There was a marriage there where I'd seen the film about Eric Cantona where the postman searching, is it searching for Eric? Looking for Eric?
Looking for Eric, I think.
Yeah. Basically, the premise of the film, this postman is getting a bit down. His life's a bit shit. He starts smoking weed. He starts seeing Eric Cantona. He keeps talking to Eric Cantona. Right. good film. but there's a bit in that. He said, what was your favourite goal you scored, Eric? And he goes, it was not the goal, it was a pass, right? And then he talks about this thing and they show this pass. I think it was to Dennis Irwin. I could be wrong. There's probably someone out there going, it wasn't Dennis Irwin. That'd probably be my agent, in fact. but it was this pass and what have you. But he said something, and I'm not going to relay it very well, but basically the essence of what he was saying was, Eric Cantona, his whole thing was that he was prepared to fall 100 times and have everyone go, you're rubbish, you're rubbish, you're rubbish.
Yeah.
But that one moment, right, that one moment. And you will never, ever get that moment unless you're prepared to fall so many
times. This is exactly what...
It's the depth of the fall that you can take to find that moment where you have to rescue it, i.e. turning, talking, and then putting yourself in that position. And then that one moment that you find where hopefully the audience realise you're going, oh, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Together, we all go, wow, there was a moment there, right? And that's why I'm prepared to take it to the depths of where I want to go. And, you know, then listening to Steve Martin and those little moments for me in that book where I just went, wow, this is game on, isn't it? I mean, it really is game on.
Something I really wanted us to talk about, and we're absolutely hitting it here, is I think you are one of the bravest comedians that I know. because you are prepared to genuinely fail. And I remember seeing you at the boat show maybe three, you can probably date it by the material, maybe 2 years ago. And it was when you ended the show by going, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of comedians like to end on their best material, but I like to do nothing for a minute and then bark like a dog.
Oh, dog, yeah, yeah.
I like to stay silent.
30 seconds of silence and then bark like a dog for a minute, yeah.
And it was indescribable. Yeah. You said it was I think it was the second time you did it, or I don't think it was the first ever. I think you tried it one night.
It would have been after that Steve Martin thing. That would have been the moments that I started to realise.
It was unbelievable. You stood there in silence for 30 seconds while everyone just looked at you going, what's he doing?
Yeah, I timed it as well perfectly on this watch. It was
and
on
then
this watch. Yeah.
You started barking like a dog.
For a perfect minute, yeah.
It was a perfect minute of comedy because halfway through that minute, people in the audience started barking like dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just was a sort of unwritable, uncreatable, you could only create that in that moment by just jumping out of the plane and going, you could have done that to silence and then turned around and walked off.
Yeah.
It could have been awful.
Yeah, but it didn't matter. Because my point is that people would have walked away from that moment. You know, I did, when did I do a show? I did something not long ago. I can't remember. It wasn't a death, but I know that people go, what? But I know that that point, oh, I know what it was. It was Greenwich Comedy Festival. This guy heckled me, right? And I just at that point was on my back because I had my feet talk, right? And of course they do. And this guy started just as I was on my back, just saying, you know, basically this is complete shit. And that was fine. What I enjoyed was, you know, one of the feet started going at this guy going, what's your problem, right? And the other shoe, you know, but I kept it in what it was. So I had the other foot going, yeah, come on, calm down, you know. So I'm putting this guy down, but staying within the play, if you like. And then the other foot got even more angry and was really going for him. And the other one's going, boy, I thought you just told me to calm down. He's going, no, fuck it. No, he's going mental at him. He's going, you could go, you know, you got a fiver and then the shoe's going, of course I've got a fiver. I've got no arms, no hands. I'm a shoe, aren't I? You know, so I started playing with the fact that, you know, I'm putting this guy down, but at the same time, I'm belittling him by actually taking no notice of him, but using that, you know, which is a certain arrogance. But, you know, the guy was so over the top. But the point I'm trying to make is, whether it was the biggest death ever, you know, I'm thinking that there will be at least 10 people in that 300 that will go, you got to come and see this guy.
Yeah.
Now, I was in Montreal this year, and I went out to do a taping, you know, film a taping. I sound like an American, but I went out to film a show there because I get TV shows in other countries, but not this one. They won't have me on the Apollo again this year, but it doesn't matter. But just quickly, I did a warm up gig in a tent in front of 30 people. And it was one of those where sometimes in comedy,
I just
realised
you said warm-up gig. I thought you said walnut. Sorry.
No, warm-up gig.
I did a warm-up gig.
But you know, Stuart...
What a walnut gig is, ladies and gentlemen.
When you do, sometimes when you do gigs and they're not going, they just, you know, from the off, it's not working. And then how many more things can go wrong?
Yeah.
And that's a weird thing, whereas I don't care. But when it becomes out of control for certain reasons, that's when actually there is a side of me goes. So I'd even inadvertently cut my head, didn't know. So I was bleeding, right? I didn't know this till after. So the audience must have been thinking, this guy's crazy, right? And then I'm trying to warm some stuff up in this tent and I'm on my back and then, of course, making my shoes talk. But then money started dropping out of my pocket, you know. And you know when you're thinking, and it was a real sort of lame one as well. No one's laughing. You just get this ping, 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 coins and then another one would fall out. And I'm thinking, so it was just one of those. So in the end, I just got up, looked at them.
It's like someone coughing in an empty.
It's just rubbish, man. Yeah. And I just went out, I pulled the curtain back and then I thought for a minute, I can't get back, can't get round there. And then I just walked out the back and then there was this silence. And then the compere come and go, I think he's gone. I think he's gone. I just picked my bag up and I could just hear him. He stepped. Anyway, Terry Arlington, ladies and gentlemen, there's this kind of, what? But you know that after that gig, the guy who books the Sydney Comedy Festival came up to me and he went, I think you're great. Do you want to come and do Sydney? So I went, I just died on my ass, literally on my back. And you see, so you never have to worry. That's my point. You know, you just do your thing. And if it's not working, you could just walk off and pick your bag up and go, oh God, I was bleeding as well, you know.
So do you...
That's the fact of it.
Pre-gig.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I want people to roar. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
I don't want to die. I mean, I'd be alive if I said I did, but... I'm prepared
to take
it.
You're prepared to.
And it's not an arrogance. Please don't think I'm being arrogant anyway.
I think
I'm
a
not.
Lot of comedians, it's just a lot of comedians, famous comedians, non-famous comedians, are satisfied with a 75% volume laugh. They want to make the whole room laugh there. But I think you're, in order to get the whole room laughing and crying laughing and creasing up, you have, I think, correctly identified that you genuinely got to risk yourself. You just can't go on and say some things that you thought. You have that incredible live quality in the moment of, as you say, they know that you don't know what happens next. They know that you don't know what's going to happen.
But they also
next.
Know I am going to rescue it.
But exactly, yeah, they believe in
because
you.
Because I will have it, like I said about the rainbow inside your mind, I will have something to rescue. But then again, you know, if you see me in a late show, like, I will never go and do late shows and try and do anything, but apart from just see how far I can really, really bend it. Because there is no point at 3 a.m. trying to go, oh, here's some jokes. And you can see me, I'm on at 10:30 in the wind up. You know, you get people doing it. I'll just go out there and just see how far we can go, man. You know, the other night I did Late in Life and I started a play where the ending, it was with this young kid fighting this old bloke. You know, it was... And me coming on with no shirt and like a monster. I mean, it was just, well, Gordon Southern was on the drums playing drums. But it was just me going, where can this go, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so, I've took it even further before, but I don't want to get into that because you'll see me in the wrong light and I don't want that.
So I wanted to talk to you about how you are pre-gig. You tend to be, well, I've seen you in a couple of different states pre-gig. When we did Warwick Arts Centre, you seemed quite calm.
Yeah.
Previously to that, when I've seen you at gigs, a boat show, wherever, you've been very hopped up getting, you know, you change your shoes and you start patting around. Is that nerves? Is that energy? Well, what's the old experience?
I don't know. Years back, you know, I used to think I was going to have a heart attack before I went on. You know, I'd be standing there going, Carl, you know, because I had this whole thing that it had to be... I had to get encores and I had to have standing ovations and it wasn't a thing of that I wanted that, you know, it was a thing that if I didn't get that, then it was a failure. You know how I used to be. And I know a lot of people used to say, in my ear, you've got to calm down a bit because people think you're a bit of a wanker. Because, you know, I'd come off to massive applause and be in the dressing room going, that was shit. But what? You know, and I think it's because the perfection of what it had to be, you know, this perfection. And it's quite ironic now that, you know, now it's gone completely the other way, that of course it's not about that for me anymore. It's about what I can come away with, what interest I can come away from it. Because my rule is, it's got to be funny. And if it's not funny, I'll try and make it interesting, you know, until I can get that laugh, you know, because essentially what we're there for is to make people laugh. But equally, I think it's quite nice for an audience to walk away and go, you know, what was that about? And then let's discuss, you know. I even would love it if people, you know, were to go home going, does he want tea? Coffee? You know, that would be nice.
So you mentioned there this idea of needing to get the standing ovations, and that resonates a lot, and I'm sure with a lot of comedians and a lot of anyone that suffers from any kind of anxiety or depression or anything like that, that you have an outcome that you need rather than an outcome that you strongly desire. You know, that's kind of therapy speak, isn't it? It's easy to sort of feel like your happiness is dependent on, you know, for some people, getting laughs, for you, getting a standing ovation, or at that time.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit earlier on. I mean, you mentioned Satilapram in your show when I saw you last Friday. Mm. So let's talk about your mental problems, Terry.
There's not really a great depth. You know, I've been mentioning Satilapram on stage. If anyone doesn't know what that is, it's a bit of a crutch. It's only a little tablet, but it's a bit of a sort of, I was very down. To be honest with you, I was in a place where I was confused. I was, you know, I was strong on stage, but I could feel things. If anyone's ever felt down, it's a vicious conundrum. You know, you find yourself actually enjoying the depth of your despairs. You start trying to find things to kick yourself metaphorically in the balls with every day, you know. And you know, my wife had tried and kept going, and there was moments where I was thinking, I'm all right now, I'm fine. And then I would find myself again, even at this point, you know, artistically, and still thinking, you know, I've got this beautiful little boy at home. You know, I live in a nice house. I have a comfortable car. My mum and dad are still well and alive, and they, you know, they love me, I hope. You know, everything was fine, but there was something more. I just wanted to, you know, it become a habit of knowing that, you know, even though I had some therapy and what have you, I still knew that there was constant just could not get out of this, enjoying this kind of depression and barking at my wife, and you know, and money was becoming an issue, you know, because I'd lost so much money before, and we'd gone very, very broke, you know, and now I got myself back to a place where everything was square. But you know, this, as we all do, you know, but I think it might be a man thing as well. Could be wrong, but I think it's that wanting to be providing and for the future. And God, you're spending too much here, because you girls, how much can you spend in boots, by the way? Right, my wife, I don't know how she does it, but she spends so much money in boots. You'll be like, you've spent about 300 quid in boots, right? But it was about, I was just getting this whole OCD thing of everything was becoming, you know, and I was cleaning the house and it was all, and I was noticing it. There was another side of me. That's why I say when I'm on stage, you know, there's me and the carer, but I've realized there's someone else has realized that. But that was actually a truth, you know, it is a truth. I started to stand back from myself going, you've got to sort this out. And it's when you realize you've got to sort it out. It's that lowest, the lowest ebb, isn't it? Mm. The lowest, you know, whatever it is, but rock bottom. There you go. And I just said, right, my, and Dee said to me, she said, you're going to have to go to the doctors and see, you know, a lovely doctor here to hear is lovely. And he wasn't there. So I saw a locum who was very sweet. And she said to have some counselling. And I did this and I came back and I saw a doctor to hear. And he just said, look, you know, I'm a bit worried about giving you anything because, you know, your angst is what makes your comedy. And I said, well, if you don't give me something, there'll be no more comedy, you know, so... I would never have topped myself. I would not do that. But there was a point where I knew I was just going to destroy it all. It was all going to go. And I could sit my, we had a terrible time, as I told you, me and my wife. And I kind of had broken it, really. You know, it was broken, completely broken. And the worst thing, the moment that really got me is when I realized that, you know, I could jeopardize reading my little boy, you know, a book to go to sleep at night. And I thought that I could be in, you know, I can't be in a place where, you know, just because of this madness, that I didn't want that. You know, I wanted to be in my house at night with my family. And I thought, if I don't, so that was, that was that the point. So I went and he gave me these tablets. I only take a small amount, but it was enough. It's a serotonin level, basically. And that's where we started. And now I'm fine. And what the great thing about it is, you know, it's given me a level field now. So I kind of feel normal now. I feel quite normal.
Something that's come up. Thank you for being so candid about it.
No, but something... it's no big deal. I just, well, the only reason I say it, I know some people go, oh, trying to jump on the mental ill bandwagon. I'm not. If I'm completely honest, I want people to hear that who feel the same and think, actually, maybe I should go and see someone. Because, you know, my sister's in mental health and I said to her, look, you know, I feel there's always a stigma about taking drugs, and to a degree, you know, it's not always the answer. But you know, she was saying to me, if you had a problem with your liver or your liver or your heart, you know, you'd take a tablet. You know, and you've just got an chemical imbalance in your brain, and you know, that's fine. But what it has done, and I hope it has completely done, is it's just made me suddenly go, actually, you know, all that's running out in the world is time. You know, that's what the only concern I should have is the fact that, you know, the clock is ticking for all of us. And I don't want to bring this down here, but it's all it is, you know, oil, all this money, we're in recession. Fuck them. Excuse my language, but I don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as it'd probably be a good thing if we all did lose everything, I think, you know, and we could just break it and start again and not have properties. Like, my house is worth ridiculous amounts of money, right? It's a normal house, and you're just going, how do we get to this state? You know, I don't want to get on this, but you know, we should all be out. You know, it's like the Olympics. You know, it was supposed to be for everybody, right? There were tickets for 450 quid. Now, don't get me wrong, the Olympics lifted us all and it was a wonderful thing, but there was that bugbear. I was going, why aren't all tickets first come, first serve, at the front or at the back, 30 quid each, brilliant, right? Not the fact I've got to pay 10 quid to get in the park to go and see the event, right? Mm. It just gets to a point where you're going, what's gone wrong? Where has this greed come that even people now can't buy at a dwelling or even rent a dwelling?
Sure.
It's gone, and listen, I'm no big socialist here, but it's gone a bit wrong. And I'd like to see it go, right? And I'd like to see my house worth nothing and all of us just live and we'll go, at last, we can all just relax now.
Did you
be a nice
worry.
Place to be?
Did you? There we are. Some spontaneous.
I'll get off my soapbox now. But I honestly do believe that. I just want to just let's just, because we won't be like that at each other, will we, anymore? I want that for you. Give it me. That's my cab. Tom, calm down, Tom.
Terry, calm
yes,
down.
I have.
So, Did you worry when you started taking the tablets? Did you have any concern?
Yes,
that it might, because I think we're all familiar with this cliche of comedians. It's the angst, it's the hurt that makes the funniness. And I'm sure we can think of
just
famous
proved it
examples.
Just then. This is why, since I hit the towers and I mastic and boarded all my house up, right? That was a real low point. That was a real dressing gown phase. That was, but I stopped reading newspapers and I don't. I did Andre's and Britstock's show the other day. And
yeah,
I shouldn't have done it really.
Yeah.
It's rubbish because I haven't read papers and I don't do papers. But it was quite funny looking at the kind of the Suns and the Mirrors. They are like bad soap operas, right? I swear to you, they're still going on this about those two little girls and the Solemn Murders and. Mm-hmm. I just thought this is the same story still in there. This is constant. I was just going through it, it's like Sharon's still in it. Then you know, it was you know like EastEnders. But I was going through these papers, going, this is all nonsense, and it's bad news. Abbott, bad news. Abbott, bad news. Abbott, pretty girl. Bad news. Abbott, bad news. Ad. You know, sport, football. So I steer clear of. I don't watch any of it anymore because it just brings you to a place that I don't want to be. You know, so I keep away from all that. And then of course taking the tablets. There was a. That's a very funny stage when you start taking them for that first month because you're going, oh, this is things start leveling out and then you start realizing where you've been irrational and that's where the heartbreak comes.
Okay.
Because that's the bit where you go, you know, I remember my wife going to me, you know, why are you calling me that? And me at the time going, I don't know. You know, I just wanted to be cuddled. You know, it's taking someone you love so much to a place that you just want them to go, what is wrong? You know, that's what it is. And I shouldn't be telling you people, should I? but you know, it was...
Well, I think you
realise that the hardest thing is the first month because things start changing your body a little bit and then you start realising. But the good thing is once you can realise that and you can then take it, you've got the power back. So now, I sound like someone who's actually still crazy, don't I?
But Terry, a little bit. But it's okay. Yeah, but that's your energy.
Yeah, but you know. I know I have a slight eccentricity. I know I do. But if you can have slight eccentricities, but... in all truth, honestly, you know, it's good that it's happened now because live or shit or bust, basically, I'm now at a place where I can start building it. So
I definitely think this is an absolutely valid thing to talk about because I have had times as a comedian, and I'm bearing in mind the listenership of the podcast of this show, there are a lot of new acts and a lot of people who want to be comedians, and it can be a very isolating job. And you mentioned there, taking you away from your family in the evenings. I've often thought it's almost mental illness to want to be a comedian. Because you're effectively saying to the people you love, I would rather be on the M4 driving back from Swindon on a Wednesday night.
Yeah, on your own again.
It is a true thing. So I think there will be people listening to this and perhaps people here today who have experienced that isolation, who have felt that sense of loneliness or a loss of control.
Not anyone who drives a truck or whatever.
Absolutely. But specifically regarding to performers and performers of comedy, that desperation of needing to pit yourself every night against a blank slate, a bunch of people who don't know you, who have no impulse.
Well, there's a key thing,
you.
I don't pit myself anymore.
Okay.
I don't pit myself against them when I come out. I come out going, this is what it is, and that's it.
And that, do you, that's
there,
well,
I
that's
used to pit
change.
Myself because it is true as a comic. Yeah, there is a gladiatorial thing when they go, please welcome funny guy. As a man as well, remember, you know, there are three things: you're either good looking, you're either tough, or you're funny. Right. So actually, to state that you're one of those, go, hey, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the good looking, tough Terry Alderton, and he's funny. Yeah. It makes all blokes go, well, let's see how fucking tough he is then. So it's you're right.
So that was a big change for you that you stopped.
Yeah,
feeling
I don't pit
like
myself. I come had, out and do it. I just
you don't
do
have
it.
To convince them.
No,
anymore.
No, there's nothing to convince, is there? There's no one to convince. This is it. If you don't like it, you don't like it. And sometimes I get it wrong. And there are the nights where I will be going, oh, you know.
Yeah,
I went too far with that. It was too much about the old people on the bus eating cake, you know. I shouldn't have done the shuffling bread. You know, I shouldn't, you know, there are moments where I technically know that I may have slipped.
Yes, but that's a very different feeling.
Yeah, that's
too.
Different. That's a professional side of me going, oh, you know, it's like anyone painting. Is it going, oh, I'm going to have to redo that because I can't redo it. I've already done it. I've thrown it out there.
I thought about it recently, like to try and think of yourself as a chef and go, okay, well, tonight the souffle didn't rise. That's not the fault of the ingredients or me or the oven or the kitchen or whatever. It's just sometimes it doesn't go off.
No.
And that's actually quite a relief to go, that's okay, I still believe in the thing. Because it can be, we've all had those long dark nights of the soul, long dark drives of the soul. You know,
here we go, why am I doing this anymore? I can't do it, I've got to change it. And well, Tuesday night that, and I came off of Stoves Tuesday night and I was just going, right, this is all wrong. You know, this is all wrong. You know, because the thing is, once I light the paper and it's off, you know, it's off. I can't break it. You know, yeah. The old me could have gone and found another way to make the audience laugh. But the thing is, I have to, because otherwise... I lose the integrity. It's broken. I can't break the integrity of it. Once it's loaded and I fire it, it has to go.
Yeah. Do you think that you have a health, either on and off stage? I'll ask you both questions. Do you think that on stage while it's going on, or off stage while you're thinking about it, do you think you have a healthy understanding of the sheer number of times it has worked, you have been hilarious, it has made a difference to people's days and evenings and lives? Mm. And do you know what I mean? Do you feel like... Like, I feel like you have earned happiness, and you don't need to earn happiness. You could be happy anyway, but also you've been really fucking funny night after night after night. Are you able to remember those things when it's going badly?
I don't even hear it when I'm on there. So I know it's gone well because I have that feeling of that wow, you know, or that feeling of ugh. And then if I'm the only way I can describe this, people are listening, I'm putting my hand over my face like I look like Bane now. But this is how I am when I'm on. That's all I'm seeing and I'm hearing, and I don't really hear the laughter. I feel it. It's warm. It's there. I'm part of you all. And, you know, but it's this kind of, I've immersed myself in this place. And we're on one, right? You know, this act, this thing is happening. It's not until the actual finish that I end that I actually then, when I sum up at the end and thank the crowd, that's when I've kind of popped it and I've come out and I'm now me. Mm-hmm. So if anyone comes to now, you'll know when I'm saying thank you, that's where I've kind of gone. And I'll let you into another secret. If ever you do see me, you'll know when I'm finding something a bit eggy. It's because I've got my eyes closed. When I'm doing something, I'm going, oh no, I don't know about this bit. If you go, he's got his eyes closed, he's obviously not enjoying this bit. Right? So then I'll probably go to the back of the room and have a chat with myself. But
I said to my friend last night, when he came to see me last night, and I said, you'll know if I'm having a tough one, because I'll look at you, I'll give you a signal, what will I do? And he went, no, I'll know if you're having a tough one. You will.
But I just thought of something I banged on about, so I was just going to quickly revisit something there about not reading newspapers or all that. And you were saying about depression and comics and press.
Sure.
I think the problem is with comics and all of us, but mainly more people who perform and have to write something, even radio presenters and stuff, is I think what you do is a comic, you start believing in the conspiracy and you find your own conspiracy, and that then tumbles it all off if you're already in that place.
I've
so you're reading something
and
then you're going, oh God, it's all ending.
Of
course it's not, you know, it's what it is. So sorry, that just wanted to revisit that, just to really...
Do you mean
I've been watching too much Breaking Bad. I was just like, what the whole time?
Okay, so listen, we've got to wrap up very soon. If anyone has any questions...
That's gone quicker than my own show, that, hasn't it?
There's a moment where if you'd like to think of a question or put your hand up, that's fine. You could ask through me. Hello there. So given that Steve Martin worked on the same act, the same hour for years and years and years, I mean, like decades, do you think that the pressure to come up with a new hour every year, if you're on the Edinburgh circuit, do you think that's too much pressure for comics?
I totally agree with that. And I think it's a funny thing in this day and age where you take the turd and you polish it and you get it just beautiful. And then you go, right, I've got to drop that. I think the best performances you'll ever see of me is if I can just actually take like 3 hours, 4 hours of stuff in my head and just grab it for an hour. I think that's where, for me personally, even if you prepare to go, well, we've seen this, but you know, I think that's true. I think if you could just, you know, just all the bits that are polished and ready to go and you could just snap at all of them, I think it would be much better. Unless, of course, you're doing some sort of play, you know, written piece or whatever. But for me personally, I mean, Steve Martin, you're right. I mean, the beauty about Steve Martin was the stuff that, you know, when you'd seen it 100 times, but you knew he'd got it just so tight. And I think once it's tight and you've got the rhythm, it's because I'm a firm believer in rhythms, you see. So, and it goes country to country, it's always a different kind of rhythm, but it's about walking on the stage and having your beat from the moment that you come on and you're in your thing. And when you're so confident about something that you do, as Steve Martin was about, you know, King Tut and all that, and he knows he's going to get to that. So he's full of it. Of course I'm a wild and crazy guy. He's full of it because he knows it's going to get big laughs and he knows it's going to, and that's when you know the audience are going to feed off this, we're all part of this. an audience can sense when you're when you're doing new stuff that you're not quite sure about, because we can all feel it. There's that universe thing. If you notice that, no one says in these new TV shows now of Asgard. It's not that everyone talks about the universe now. See, that's growing, and that's the new thing. But it's true. Just watch. I asked the universe. The universe said so. I think you're right. I think it'd be nice if we could just get a tight hour that we know that is so honed and polished. And
it would almost put you in the same position as a band, where you could do your greatest hits. You could do some new stuff.
Yeah, but
and you
know
could
what? It's a true fact that all comics talk about this. So it is true. A lot of people still. This is what we assume. This is dressing room talk now. We think that actually people will want to come, and you might as well keep doing that, because people will come up to you asking, why don't you do that bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
But then you've got that fine line where I still am letting myself down because I need to get to my feet, and I've not come up with anything else yet. But, you know, when I was talking to people about it, and they're going, you know, you've got to let yourself down. But there's that fine line to still be doing that. Some people go, I hope he lets himself down. Other people go, oh, he's still letting himself down. So
I should point out, letting himself down refers to a specific bit of material where I act out deflate.
I literally deflate myself. And
otherwise,
the gag is I've let
otherwise,
myself
semiotically,
down.
That's quite a difficult line of argument to follow.
Yeah, sorry. Here we go again. But
I hope you let yourself down, right? Yeah. What?
Yeah. But literally, it's a physical piece of comedy where I just deflate myself, you know, and the gag is, recently I let myself down. It's a silly joke, but it's a performance piece, which I actually enjoy doing, and it gets me a chance to put my feet out. But, you know, I know there's some people go, why don't you let yourself down tonight? And you go, I can't keep doing it. And so you go, but if you, like I said, if you do it, then people go, oh, you're still doing that, are you? And you go,
is there any way? Is there any way, though?
You didn't care about it. I thought you didn't care. So, you know, it's one of those.
Is there any way that you could make a version of your show? You could be the, you know, your pioneering thing could be that you don't let go of those bits, like Steve Martin.
Well, you could say that. But my goal is that eventually, I want it to be a piece. I don't want it to be stand-up anymore. I want it to be a complete piece where people... I'm in a sifting phase at the moment. I'm sifting out, right? And I'm not physically saying I don't want people there, but I need to get to a point where I know that I'm walking on in front of 1,000 people in a theatre, and every single one of those people knows exactly what they're in for.
Yeah.
The once we get to that, right, then it's gonna. I'm going to lift this open, and we are really going to go. It's really going to go. But I need to be confident that everybody out there is going to help me spin the place, right?
Yeah.
Until I've got that confidence, then, and that's when I'm really gonna take it there, because I can't quite yet. And it's not like I said to you, I'm not pitting myself against an audience. I don't care what an audience thinks. You go, you said all that, but there is a degree age that I know that if I can get to that point when I complete that, if you call it Zen, whatever you want to call it, I know that when I walk out and everybody's there and we're all going, are we all ready for this? And everyone's going, yes, we are. Let's get it on. You know, that's the point.
I think that's a beautiful place to end it. We have, in fact, run out of time. I've just been waiting for you to say something profound. And yeah, let's go there. Good.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Terry Alderton.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I really hope Terry gets what he wants. And I would love to be in that audience where everyone's on board, where everyone's a receptor to this catalyst of madness that he brings. But also, you know, you go and see him in a club and everyone is. So just track him down wherever you can see him. Finally then, remember, get yourself some tickets for Nish Kumar at the Soho Theatre on the 24th to the 26th of January, and tickets for the James Acaster ComCom special on Wednesday the 6th of Feb at a secret location in central London. They're available online with the link from comedianscomedian.com. I'm going on holiday next week, but if I can possibly get another episode online, I will. If I don't, I just want you to know, I'm not going to feel guilty, all right? I'm on holiday. That's what holidays are for. So thank you to Terry. Thanks to BBC Worldwide, Le Petit Horas, and all of my technical and internet helpers. Go and see Nish, and I'll speak to you very soon, in a week or two, maybe three. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.